This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host, and this week we chat with tenor Isai Jess Munoz. He, along with his wife Oksana Gluchko, have released a recording on Bridge Records of Catalan art songs titled Visca l'Amor, works of six Catalan composers. These composers of these songs represent a people fiercely independent, be it in their language, history, or self-government, and they've always poured much into their music. And though Catalan Spanish singers have recorded these songs, this is the first North American artist to do so. My guest, also, as you'll hear, is deeply committed to the production and realization of new opera, as well as educating younger folks about this art form. From the Catalan Art Songs disc, you're hearing the title track, Visca l'Amor, Long Live Love, from Eduard Toldra, 1895 to 1962. I spoke with Isai Jess Munoz via Zoom back in April.
Very happy today to be speaking with tenor Isai Jess Munoz. Congratulations on the new CD. For someone whose career and repertoire, vocally speaking, is dedicated to new works and underappreciated repertoire, on this new recording, you take on an entire culture with their own language and history. So a few things here. First of all, talk about the Catalan art and Catalan music, if you would, especially, you know, its history of repression and things. So just talk about, in general, the art form you took on here.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really want to thank those who are listening today. Catalonia, or Catalunya, is the autonomous region in Spain whose language was censored by the Franco dictatorship between the years of 1937 through 1975, roughly, give or take some years before and after. And so as a result, any composer who was setting the Catalan language to sung application, their musical works were then also censored. And so what ended up happening was that for decades, these composers were writing and setting texts by native poets behind closed doors. And some of this music was able to be published in other countries, such as France and Germany. But it wasn't until after the Franco dictatorship ended and the censorship of the Catalan language lifted that local publishing houses that were all but decimated at that point were able to begin recovering these countless number of scores and musical compositions and begin publishing them and making them available to the general public. And so it's nice to see that in the last 20 or so years, these local publishing houses have begun to disseminate this. And it's our joy to be among the first North Americans to be producing an album solely devoted to this song literature. There have been several native singers that have recorded this repertoire. If you think of Victoria de los Angeles or Montserrat Caballé, José Carreras, they were among the first to do full albums. Of course, they're native Catalonians. And along the way, the younger generation have followed suit, but we're the first North Americans to do a full recording of this repertoire.
How did you and your wife, who's the pianist on this disc, Oksana Gluchko, how did you discover this rep? I mean, how did this come across your radar?
Sure. Well, something very interesting happens still today inside of conservatories of music, and that's that mostly the focus is relegated to Central European song literature, which interestingly excludes Spain. Often excludes Spain. So we're talking about French song literature, German song literature, Italian, of course. And so throughout my undergrad and even graduate years, I didn't have the opportunity to delve into the music of my own heritage. I'm a fluent Spanish speaker. I'm half Puerto Rican, half Mexican. Right. And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to go back to school to pursue my doctorate, I'd love to finally have an opportunity to get to become more familiar with Iberian and Latin American song and Iberian and Latin American music at large. And I had been asked by many producers and other arts organizations, hey, do you have an art song recital of Spanish literature that you can offer? And I had never built one. And so I made plans to devote my doctoral studies to the study of Iberian Latin American art song. And I ended up receiving a grant from the Tinker Fellowship, the Tinker Foundation, to go and do some exploratory work in Spain, in Barcelona. And I was pretty much thinking that I was going to have the opportunity to focus on some of those composers that we know here in the States, such as Obradors and Granados. But I ended up working with a musicologist there who just opened up a whole world to me, which included Catalan art song. And I ended up visiting the Biblioteca de Catalunya, the main library in Catalonia that houses the archives of Manuel de Falla and also a famous soprano who premiered many of these Catalonian pieces called Conchita Padilla. Their archives are housed there. And what I found was just this treasure trove of exciting repertoire. And I immediately knew that I had to investigate this language that's very singable further. This happened back in 2010. And since then, Oksana and I have been programming this literature in recitals, exploring it, and it's been a joy to live out that process.
So we'll plunge into my guest, Isai Jess Munoz's new Catalan art song CD in a moment, but I thought we'd hear him sing much more familiar repertoire here accompanied by his wife, the Russian-Israeli-American pianist Oksana Kluchko, music from Handel's Messiah.
Well, two things there which are interesting is that the university core repertoire of leaders focusing on German and French, and yet Spanish is probably the language that most of these students are fluent in as far as a second language. It's kind of funny. And also the fact that you may have wanted to do Spanish songs, but a number of years ago, I do announcements for a youth orchestra in this area. They go on European tours every other year. So we went to Barcelona years ago, and our tour guide was Catalan. I had to announce the concerts in the language, and he made sure that I said good evening and thank you and all that stuff in Catalan, because when you got to that biblioteca, you realized you're not going to speak Spanish. You have to speak Catalan. You have to do it in the dialect, right?
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the really interesting things is that while we were doing all of this research, many listeners will recall that in 2017, Catalonia, they arose again, the Catalonian people seeking independence from Spain. And that rhetoric and those strong arguments that they pose are still very alive and very visceral today, and they continue. And so, yes, the Catalonians, they have once again, they've been able to successfully put in place the Catalan language as an official language of Spain one more time and as the official language of Barcelona. And with that, of course, comes a celebration of all things Catalan, including the music.
Yeah, and they're very proud of that language and they want to hear it spoken. It's a very interesting thing. And of course, you had to learn all that, those different words, the different pronunciations of words, which aren't quite Spanish.
Well, and you pointed to the fact that there are regionalisms, that there are dialects, right?
Right.
There are 18 different dialects inside of the Catalonian language, which is really interesting.
Wow.
Catalan is not only spoken in the Barcelona region, but it's also spoken in Andorra and Algarve, Italy, and of course, the Balearic Islands. And so it's very interesting to see how the language shares the same spelling, but yet how the language is pronounced differently. And it is important to note that it is a language in its own right. It's not a dialect of Spanish or French. It holds similarities to the other Romance languages like Italian and French and Spanish, but it is a language in its own right.
So talk about some of the composers on the disc. How did you filter what would go on the disc? Because you've got a range here from Catalan composers, kind of Spanish composers citing Catalan poets, even a modern, you know, contemporary composer. So, I mean, talk about, you know, how you filtered what would go on this CD.
Sure. That's a great question. So it really has two prongs to it. So I'll tackle the first part of that, which is so much of this repertoire has, or some of the repertoire at least, has been recorded primarily by sopranos or mezzo sopranos. But so much of this repertoire has not been recorded by male voices, the baritone, the bass baritone, the tenor. And so I really wanted to make sure that I could first find repertoire that really fit my voice well, that fit the tenor range well. And I'm happy to report that this is not a genre or subgenre of art song that's relegated only to sopranos. There's literature for all voice classifications and all temperaments. And I'll tell you that it was difficult for me to narrow down which composers I wanted to focus on because there was so much repertoire and beautiful repertoire. But ultimately, and this leads us to the second prong of narrowing down our list of repertoire, it's the holistic picture of this body of repertoire that really interested me. The title of the album is Viscat l'amor, or Long Live Love. But I often clarify to people who ask that the title is not simply pointing to romance. Although the melodies contained on the disc are very beautiful and the poetry itself often points to physical desire, I always tell them it's not a Valentine's Day album. More importantly, what I think this project is documenting is the cry for love of country, fraternal affection, for national identity, a yearning that can really be explored through these musical and poetic colors. So these composers were all part of that journey of the Catalonian people throughout the 20th century. And it was also really important for us to not only pay tribute to the music of the past, but also to celebrate the work of living Catalonian composers who today are producing incredible works of art. And so the New World premiere that we have, written by Elisenda Fabregas, who I think is one of the great living composers of our day, was part of that aspect of the mission. And, you know, just to say just one final thing about the narratives of these composers, I think that part of what's really compelling about them is that we can see how inherent in so many human stories can sometimes be the frustration of seeing one's hopes or hard work either halted or not fully realized. And that's certainly what these artists were facing. But the way that they dealt with it is that through their art, they were attempting to break free from the constraints of their present state, to draw on what they were experiencing, to make peace and to make a positive difference through their art. And so what we found was that performing and sharing these pieces in a way makes us feel like active participants in their noble legacy. So it's our hope that the narratives of their music remind us to continue walking humbly and with care through those kinds of things that they themselves faced.
Well, it's an interesting disc the way you laid it out, because two-thirds of it, or three-quarters of it even, are songs that express the whole human emotion from love and all that stuff. And some composers who had pretty good representation disc, maybe not with their songs, but Mampo and Toldra. And then you have the Fabregas, you said, to this contemporary. And then he closes, moving to the sacred, with this very interesting music by Joan Cameas, or I guess if it's Catalan, Camelas? I don't know how the Catalans do those L's. But, you know, these multiple settings of just the word Alleluia, it's a really fascinating, like you said, it gives you a wider spectrum of this is the Catalan art song. And, you know, it's not just focusing on a certain period. So I commend you for that.
Turning to my guest, Isaias Munoz's new CD on Bridge of Catalan Art Songs, sets of songs composed by six Catalan composers, five of which who are men who have passed on, but there's also a set from the contemporary composer Alessandra Fabregas, her four-song cycle Intimazio del Foc. This is the final song, Ardent Hymn, my guest accompanied by his wife on piano, Oksana Gluchko.
plexus, darling, send me. Arriban alas meets, covered head and the heart, Garan, guardia bones, crevats, arena, sendra, Garan, guardia bones, crevats, arena, sendra. Ruins Avaranis Volen a vol les flames Atuades Homes o nas Tan llargues cavalleres Comporten Amb l'esposa del menino Noio
This gift you have to discover and uncover and bring to light music is wonderful. It's a great trait of your career. But I usually try to dig in on the artists I interview to find out where this all comes from. And you are one of those frustrating artists that no matter where you look on the internet, you can't find your background. Now, you said you're of Mexican and Puerto Rican heritage, but I mean, where do you come from? Was your family musical, your discovery of your voice, mentorship, encouragement? And you kind of mentioned in one thing that you grew up in an atmosphere of musical theater. So give us some background because you can't find it on the internet.
Well, sure. Well, I'd be happy to share a little bit on my trajectory. Well, actually, my family was extremely musical, but not attuned to classical music per se. My parents are both ordained ministers, so I grew up singing in the church for most of my life. But my dad also had a DJ job on the side. He loved being a DJ. And so we grew up in a household that was filled with many eclectic sounds, everything from liturgical repertoire to bachata to merengue to salsa. And then when I was 9 years old, the young artist singer,
Where was this, by the way?
Well, I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I was born in California, but I grew up in Orlando. And the young artist singers of the Orlando Opera Company, they visited my grade school. And I vividly remember I was in the fifth grade. So I'm in my 40s now. So this was a while back.
Right.
But they came and they sang a children's opera. And oh my goodness, it was just a smorgasbord of phenomenal singing, unlike anything I had ever heard in my life. And I ran home that day and I told my parents, I know what I want to do for the rest of my life. And they said, well, what's that? And I said, well, I want to be an opera singer. And you can imagine the look, you know, on their faces, because this wasn't we heard all kinds of music, but not that.
Right.
But I'll admit I was a pretty tenacious child. So I pushed my mom to call that opera company and to see if there was something that a little kid like me could do. And she called and they said, well, actually, it's like divine intervention that you're calling us, because we're holding auditions for our children's opera chorus in 3 weeks and he's welcome to come in and sing for us. And so I remember walking into that audition site that day. There was over 100 kids there for the audition and all of them had sheet music in hand. I didn't even know what sheet music was. I had a boombox. And I had an accompaniment track of a contemporary Christian piece, because after all, I grew up in the church and sang a lot. So I went in there and I sang a song with a bunch of pathos of conversion and forgiveness of sin or whatever. And they heard something in the voice. They heard something that had potential, because along with all the music that I was hearing, I would hear mariachi, and my dad would put that Mexican mariachi hat on me and the poncho. And for those who like mariachi or have heard mariachi, you know that there's a lot of vibrato in that tone. So I thought, well, this is opera, and I heard those people use the vibrato, so you know, and I went there and they heard something. And, you know, I didn't come from an affluent home. They gave me a scholarship. I was trained under them. That prepared me for performing arts high school. And then I did my undergrad at Cincinnati Conservatory, right, and then the Manhattan School of Music, and the rest is kind of history. And I decided to stay in New York. That was my home base. And I performed regionally a lot as a spieltenor, as a character tenor, and then decided to do my doctorate, which leads us back to that period of time when I discovered all this repertoire. And it's my joy to now serve as associate professor of voice and opera at the University of Delaware.
Right.
And as a vice president for National Opera Association. And I say this because one of the things that I advocate for is outreach of music in the schools, among the grassroots, that we're giving back to community. You never know who's out there. Had someone not come to my elementary school that way and impacted my life with the gift of classical music, I would not be speaking to you today.
Yeah.
And so I always try to share that when I can, because we need to keep the arts alive, and we need to continue giving youth and children access to opportunities like what I experienced.
That's amazing that you would set your course on the voice even before you were 10. That's really quite a story, which should be on the internet somewhere, by the way.
I guess, yeah. Well, now it will be, I guess, if you choose to share it.
Right. So my guest, Isaias Munoz, champions new operas. Here he is in the part of Medvedenko in American composer Thomas Pastieri's setting of Anton Chekhov's 1896 play The Seagull. The other voice you'll hear in the part of Masha is Carrie Behan. This scene, You Always Wear Black.
Kindly, no.
you've really been presence in contemporary opera and many of the works you've appeared in, with maybe the exception of a couple, and I'll mention one here because I work with him closely because he's the artist in residence at the Institute for Advanced Study, which is Einstein's think tank in Princeton, and he's going in a second term. That's David Lang, and you were with him for his Prisoner of the State, which was the Met. But most of the composers in the operas you do are not appearing on the roster of big opera houses anywhere. If they do, it's once and gone. So talk about the challenges and rewards of doing new opera projects, brand new operas.
You're really speaking to my heart.
Yeah.
It's one of the great joys that I get to live out and delve in every single day. I had mentioned that I serve at the National Opera Association, and part of my duties there is that I chair an initiative called the Sacred in Opera Initiative, which studies the interplay between the ideologies of world religions and opera. And through that, we champion the works of living composers. And in recent years, we've been able to highlight works inspired by Baha'i, Tibetan, Islamic, Catholic faiths, and to really have that interfaith dialectic happening. And yes, of course, it's just a joyful experience to be able to disseminate the work of my colleagues and to pair them with singers to cast often those productions and to just live out the workshop experience. That is just so rich. One thing is, you know, the final product that the audience receives, but another thing is to just be in the room as you have those special moments where these composers who are unbelievably talented are humbly approaching the singer saying, what is it that you need? How best can we serve your voice in relation to the needs of the story and whatnot? And I often tell colleagues and just other people who may be interested in this topic that I do believe that we're living in the golden age of American opera today. I really do believe that. Whereas we think of opera as something that was primarily Italian or something right. that was German. Right now, I mean, the hotspot really is the United States. And we think of opera companies like Opera Philadelphia or even Opera Orlando now, which right. is a young, booming company, because the company that I grew up in went defunct, sadly, about 10 years ago, and now they're starting again. But they're commissioning and they're partnering with living composers, and we're hearing the American voice through opera in a way like we've never heard it before. And so I'm so excited to see us move out of this pandemic in a safe way once again, where we can be live and experiencing in person once again the works of these incredible American composers.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, I've had composers who have really stretched the boundaries of opera. Christopher Sirona with his work that's done in the Los Angeles train station, and Lisa Bielava doing an opera that's basically a serialized, which you can like binge watch it, you know, it's in segments. And so thinking outside, but there are challenges here because, I mean, most of these operas are written for a stage in a one night performance, and just getting these operas performed, recorded, but then getting them into the repertoire so that opera houses who need to put on the Mozarts, the Rossini, Donizetti, Verdi, Puccini, and others just to fill the seats and to have the, you know, ticket sales. But how do you get them to try something new? I mean, it's really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at what Opera Philadelphia is doing, it's still very much an anomaly, right?
Right.
Because you have the opera houses, you know, at the grassroots level that have patrons and audience members that still want to see the standard, right? The La Bohème's, the Tosca's. So one of the things that I try to do is, yes, to create platforms and opportunities for these composers. One of the things that we find that is effective is to get their works workshopped and premiered at universities, at colleges. Right. Because it can also be an extremely formative experience for the student to get to work with living composers. And we also feel that by doing that, we're also building the future of opera in terms of audiences and also performers and singers. So it's difficult to gauge what the canon of operatic literature will look like 50 years from now. But I think that we're doing all that we can to champion the work of these composers today. We can be doing much, much more But of course, we understand the constraints that professional organizations have. At the end of the day, we don't want to see anybody have to close their doors because they've programmed so much obscure repertoire that no one's coming to the seats. But I think now more than ever, you know, we see how social media has completely exploded the way in which we communicate with our audiences. And so it may need some slogans, right, that really bring people in some kind of ways and stuff. It's kind of difficult to say, but we see people really thinking outside the box and thinking in smart and interesting ways to bring those skeptics still into the halls. And so I think we're still learning as we go, but the desire is there and the heart is there, certainly from the side of the composers, the side of the artists, and those members of our marketing teams who are working around the clock to try to make a compelling case for audience members. And I will say that if you have not yet gone out to see a contemporary opera, contemporary work, you're really missing something special. I often tell people that there's this hybrid also happening. Opera, it's no longer just bel canto or Puccini or even Baroque. We're seeing these hybrids happening, right? You look at a company like Beth Morrison Projects. I had talked to you about how we've showcased Tibetan and Baha'i. When you bring in these kinds of dialectics, you're also bringing different cultural understandings of how music works. You're going outside of the practice of westernized art. And so that brings in all these interesting and powerful, rich sounds. So I invite you to take a chance on new opera.
Well, it's interesting because these contemporary composers are picking subjects or librettos which much more resonate with our current living conditions than do a lot of the 19th century or certainly the 18th century librettos. And I've also thought for years, and I don't know how practical it is now in 2021, but I thought like 10 years ago that, where opera might be better living, it's great to have a live audience on stage, but if it's filmed, you know, to get it on like a TV channel, which have to be funded, and I don't know who would put up the money, but it would just show these contemporary operas because there's subject matters in there that some people might pick up on, you know? It's more relevant to them than seeing something from the past. It's still a challenge, but you're right. I think the golden age of what's being written by the full spectrum of composers. I mean, you think of Ellen Reid winning the Pulitzer Prize with that opera about, you know, sexual assault and the aftermath of that. How relevant can that be, you know? So, yeah.
Well, it's a powerful thing that you bring up because, you know, when I'm teaching at the University of Delaware, I'm dealing and working and collaborating with millennials, right? They're thinking in very distinct ways when it comes to issues surrounding social justice, right? Take an issue like homelessness, and the list goes on and on, right? Obviously, BLM these days. And they want their music to speak into those pandemics, right? It's more than the COVID pandemic that's happening, right? We've had many, many pandemics happening for a long, long time. Right. And millennials, they are ready to speak into them. So I think that we're going to be seeing many more operas that are focusing on these issues.
Cantus et rea quasi prosfonada ias mortals a carga tandualsus presens.
Once again, from the CD of Catalan art songs titled Visca l'amor, here is a song from the Catalan composer Ricard Lamota de Grignon from his four-movement cycle Cants Omaris, signaling up the ancient Greeks. This is the final song, Aphrodite.
Procurare da tu
you mentioned this, but both you and your wife teach at the University of Delaware. You're a professor of voice and opera. And I'm just curious, when professional artists do this, of why you teach and what it brings to your career to teach.
You know, from a young age, I realized that I really loved teaching. And I love the interplay between how teaching and performing informed each other. So when I was doing my grad work at the Manhattan School of Music, that's also when I began to teach privately. And at first it became just, you know, a way to make ends meet. And I ended up really loving it. And what would happen is that when I would teach a student, that would inevitably cause me to start reflecting on what was happening in my own throat and how to better explain that. And how to explain just the whole process, right? Because it's not just about the physiological experience, but everything else, right? How do you build a character and your physical gestural action on stage and all of those things. And so once I graduated and I started working professionally, I continued to teach. And it just so happened that I had several buddies of mine who were musical theater majors at the Cincinnati Conservatory and had moved to New York around the same time. And they were auditioning for Broadway shows. And they would call me periodically and they would say, "Hey, Jess, I'm totally broke, but I have a callback to Les Mis, or I have a callback to Phantom. Can you hear this side for me and tell me if it sounds okay?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And they would tell me, "Well, I can't pay you." And I would tell them, "Well, you know, don't worry about it. If you land a Broadway show, just refer me to people in your show." So before I knew it, they landed Broadway shows. And then I had a full studio of a bunch of singers who were on Broadway and national tours. And it worked out great because they were very busy. I was busy also. I would have to leave and perform. So when I would be in town, they would check in with me. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun to just serve that community for about 10 years. And I try to bring that information to students today and to build upon that. It's been really interesting to see how young people have evolved through the years. I feel like they get younger and younger. And I also feel like the students I was teaching 5 years ago aren't the same kind of students that we're teaching today. Again, social media really colors. I think technology continues to color the way in which people learn. It's always fun to be a part of that and to see that evolving and also to hear from them, because again, I think that it also informs the work that I continue to do on stage and to tackle the kinds of subjects and topics that I tackle. Inevitably, it's informed by what they bring to the table. I always tell my students, I learn as much from you as perhaps you feel that you learn from me.
Yeah, and technology is a good and bad side because you can do parroting, but you can tell your student or students, go listen to this performance of this piece, and they could bring it up on their phone before you even finish the sentence, which, you know, years before you had to go to the library and find the recording, hours and hours, and now it's just instantaneous. You had something online about your teaching philosophy, and one sentence really stuck me, and I just want to read the sentence to you and you comment on it. It says, "It is important that educators never forget that music, if merely for its ability to be expressed, should always carry with it undertones of great joy." It's a great sentence, but talk about that.
I'm about to get emotional. It's at the core of what I believe when I teach students. I always tell them, the voice is you, but the voice is not you. And what I mean by that is that if your cousin calls you up on the phone, they may not have to say their name. You may immediately know, depending on the relationship that you have with them, immediately know that it's them. So we can identify people by their voice without even opening our eyes, without even seeing them. And so inevitably, as singers are learning how to open up their throat and to sing more freely and to prepare their voice for professional performance, it becomes very easy for them to begin identifying who they are based on what's coming out of their throat. This is a very competitive field. It's a field that has incredible highs and also has incredible lows. And so one of the things I try to instill in them is that they are so much more than their voice. They are a brother, they are a sister, they are a child, they are a parent, they are a friend. They are a lover of culinary arts. They are a lover of golf and poker. And that if they have a phenomenal voice lesson, if they have a phenomenal audition, that's great. And if they have a challenging audition, or if they have something happen, if they receive some feedback that's very critical or that's given in a very negative way, that they understand that that doesn't define who they are. because inevitably they're going to face that at some point in this profession. But one of the things I also tell them is something that an old acting teacher said to my acting class many, many moons ago. She was seeing us warm up and she was kind of impressed by some of the work that was happening in there. And she said, I want you guys to remember something powerful about this field. And that's that any shit that has happened to you along the way can be turned into gold. And I mean, that is part of the magic, pardon my French, but that is part of the magic of what we get to do as performing artists on the stage, is that we experience things, right? If you break a toe, your voice is going to feel it. If you lose a loved one, your voice is going to feel it. If you win $1 million, your voice is definitely going to feel it. Emotions speak to the velocity of the air and how it moves through the vocal folds, how we breathe, whether we breathe high or we breathe low. And so, yes, we can turn even those difficult moments into gold on the stage.
Or the word you use, joy, which is what really sticks out. So
yes.
just enjoying the profession. Speaking of which, we have to deal in the times we're in. And you and your wife teach at University of Delaware. You also do some teaching in New York City, which is a way of getting into the question of, I know performances have been canceled, but how have you dealt with COVID here, the two of you?
You know, it's been a colorful experience, to say the least. And every faculty member across universities nationwide has had to remain flexible and ready to pivot at a moment's notice. And we've just really tried to make the best of it with every passing day. We've been lucky at the University of Delaware and that the School of Music was one of the few units that was granted permission to be able to continue providing private lessons for instruments, including voice, in person. Wow. So what they did was that they moved me outside of my studio, which isn't terribly large, my office space, they moved me into a larger space where the singer can be 20 feet away from me.
Wow.
And then I just utilize a microphone. I sit at the piano, I utilize a microphone, and so they can hear me in an amplified way. And I can still see them, I can hear them. And so we've been able to work in that way. They remain unmasked. I put my mask on, although now I'm fully vaccinated. But that's kind of how we've worked it. So we've been very, very lucky to be able to continue having that experience. But my colleagues in the state of California, for example, that's a different thing. They've had to remain fully online for the entire year. And that poses other challenges. So I just keep telling my colleagues around the nation, we're in this together. And I join with the National Association of Teachers of Singing, National Opera Association, these other incredible organizations that are continuing to offer resources for our colleagues during this time. And then there's the aspect of just wellness of for the students and wellness for faculty members, right? At the end of the day, teachers, you know, we're not demigods, we're also humans. In our case, we have children. You know, it's a holistic journey for sure of COVID. And so we just try to do the best we can.
So perhaps the best known composer on my guest tenor Isaias Muñoz's new CD of Catalan art songs is Frederic Mompou. From his Combat del Somi, here is the first song, Damunt de tu nomes les flores, above you only flowers.
Thank you.
Performance-wise, I assume most things were canceled, but I mean, is there a light at the end of the tunnel for you performance-wise? Something coming up that...
Oh, yeah, for sure. One of the things, I guess, that we're also fortunate in is that faculty members at universities, performing artists who are at universities, are among the few that do have access to concert halls, to performance spaces,
right.
Where we've been able to continue performing at the very least virtually, right? And having access to those things that can make it feel a little more like the real deal. So for example, as soon as we're done in an hour and a half, I'm going to be doing a masterclass and singing a couple of songs for some students at Central Washington University. Wow. So we've been lucky. And also, I think that this recording project of Catalan songs has also put us in an interesting place where we've been able to remain productive simply because there was a project that was already moving up the pipeline when this happened. And so to my colleagues who are really in a state of real pause, I'm just always telling them my heart is always with them because I remember what it was like when I was that freelance artist in New York, you know, working to just make ends meet month to month. And it was possible and it was doable and it was such a fun life and it was incredible, but it's been painful to see how many of my colleagues have had to leave New York City at this time because of it. And I do believe that there's light at the end of the tunnel. I was actually seeing, or I came across a report, I forget from where exactly, that was talking about the creative brain and also neurology and how we work and how nowadays people are in such need of just a hug and of face-to-face connection that they're actually now projecting that within a year after COVID that we're going to see concert halls fuller than they've ever been, simply because neurologically speaking, people are longing human connection.
Yeah, well, we hope. And we don't know exactly how this is all going to play out, what from COVID is going to last and the other go away. But yeah, it's still going to be a trial to get people to get into that auditorium, right? You know, but I think it will happen, like you said. Which, you know, you said performance-wise, but it begs the question, what's ahead recording-wise? I mean, is there enough treasure trove of the Catalan for Volume 2? Or what are you working on there as far as next recording?
Absolutely, there is. As I had said earlier, you know, it was very hard for me to come to a decision. I think of composers like Roberto Gerhardt, which some of us may know here, right? I believe the New York Philharmonic had actually premiered several of his works, you know, in the 70s. And then I think of, you know, just other composers like Pau Casals, the famous cellist, or Pablo Casals. Some people may know him as Pablo. they were also incredible composers who set the Catalan language. And so I would love to tackle them. But, you know, I think that people are beginning to recognize that Iberian and Latin American art song is not simply relegated to Castellano or the Spanish language, but we have Catalan, we have Quechua. Of course, we have Portuguese and variants of Portuguese, Brazilian Portuguese versus European Portuguese. It's always exciting to delve deeper into Iberian and Latin American art song. So I'm interested in maybe looking into Mexican composers next. Yeah. My father, you know, he worked with his hands. He was a hardworking guy. I would love to pay homage to that part of my culture. It means a lot to me. I understand him more and more as a human, the older I get, you know, and so that would be very personally meaningful to me. But also, you know, my training was first centered in Central European song literature. And so Oksana and I, through the years, we've put together several recitals, which include French Melodie and German Lieder. So about 5 months ago, we put together a whole new program of French art song. And to be honest with you, that's what I'd really love to record. Whether people want to hear yet another album of Debussy, I don't know. But we've been encouraged to look into that a little further. Maybe we'll put a nice twist to that. You know, one of the interesting things about this project of Catalan song is that there is a clear connection between the influences of French Impressionism and Neoclassicism, because so many of these composers who faced repression in Spain ended up going to France to study at the Paris Conservatoire, working with people like Vincent Dandy and Ravel and rubbing shoulders with Debussy and other composers who are in the active performing canon. So the repertoire is rich. And if you think about French Impressionism and you like composers like Fauré or Debussy, you're going to love Catalan art song because it moves along those lines as well.
We can always do the Spanish or Catalan album and drop in a few of those French songs, because all those French composers were enamored with Spanish exoticism as they saw it in some way or another. So, you know, there's always stuff to talk. Well, we'll look forward to anything you have coming up in the future.
So once again, from my guest's new CD on Bridge Records of Catalan art songs, turning once again to the composer Eduard Toldra, who opens the CD and opened our program, another song from his cycle La Rosa als Flavis, The Rose at the Lips, this the song I el seu escard. With your gaze over my gaze, I'm a prisoner about a simple, powerful kiss. My guest tenor, Isai Jess Munoz, is accompanied by his wife, Oksana Gluchko.
I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we are, of course, it's COVID, so via Zoom. But if you could chat with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk to or weren't able to talk to, but you could. I'm just wondering what name pops into your head first. You can get flooded with names, but what name popped into your head when I asked that question?
Oh my goodness. Wow, that is a powerful question. Oh, there are so many people in history that have just touched my life.
What's the first name that just popped
up? Well, actually, interestingly enough, just the first name that passes to my mind is Enrique Granados.
Wow, okay.
Because just yesterday evening, I was reading more into his life, and he passed away at the age of 49, interestingly enough.
Well,
he drowned.
Yes.
Yeah. Saving his wife.
Right.
And like me, he was a father. He had six children. I have three. He's an interesting guy in that we have recordings of him playing his own music. And one of the things that he was most known for was improvisation at the piano. And one of the pieces that he wrote, I heard it recorded, and it was so free. It wasn't at all what you would see on the written page. And for so many reasons, I would love to talk with him about that. Because one of the things I often say is that, you know, Spanish art song, it's trying to notate that improvised aspect, and yet Western notation falls short often. And so just to pick his brain on that, but also to pick his brain as an artist who was a dad with multiple kids. And in that period of time, I was just moved by his story.
If he hadn't picked the wrong ship, which got torpedoed by a German submarine, you know, I think he would have been a real driving force in Spanish music, because he was going in directions, and everything we have from him is so rich and so wonderful that he would have kept creating, and he might have gone into different areas, even film or something. Who knows what he would have gone into. Second question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on this program in normal times fills their life with music, as you and Oksana do. When you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but pull yourself away from music, what do you like to do? What do you do?
Well, two things. And I would say the second one is also grounded in the first one, which is just love on our kids. Now more than ever, before I had kids, it was all about ushering students into play, because I think that through political correctness and all the number of times that our teachers tell us, no, don't do that, or you can't do that, you know, we kind of also strip children and consequently growing adults of the permission to just play. And right. To be free. And so my kids have totally filled my life once again with that whole aspect of play and silliness and just watching all kinds of crazy things with them. And
what are their ages?
9, 7, and 6.
Oh, okay. So we are heavily adult.
We're in the land of make-believe. And part of that is also cooking. We love the culinary arts, and we just love to cook and fill our tummies with more and more joy with every passing day. So I also have to visit the gym.
Okay. Does your cuisine highlight your heritage? Is that what you delve into?
Well, Oksana's Russian-Israeli.
Yes, yeah, I know.
And so our house is colored by the flavors of both of our worlds. And people often say, well, what's Israeli cuisine? Oh my gosh, it's so global. Yeah. And it's so delicious, because the Jewish people cover the face of the earth.
Right.
And they move back to Israel and they bring the flavors of their lands to the homeland. And so it's just unbelievable. Through the years, Oksana has just amassed a treasure trove of incredible culinary delights. And so we just try something new every week.
Your household sounds hectic and delicious. There you go. Isaias Munoz, thanks for taking some time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to speak with you.
Tenor Isaias Munoz. You can find out more about him at his website, Jess, J-E-S-S Munoz, M-U-N-O-Z, jessmunoz.com. And his new recording of Catalan art songs, Visca l'Amor, with his wife, pianist Oksana Gluchko, is on the Bridge Records label. Check it out at bridgerecords.com. I'll leave you with two movements. The first and final fifth movement of Juan Comeas, who lived from 1913 to 2000, cycle Les Paroles Sagrades, setting the word Alleluia. Oksana Gluchko at the piano, and the voice is that of my guest today, tenor Isaias Munoz. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
Alleluia, 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 alleluia.